everyone is appreciating this discussion of Didi Kashyapamuni. And today Indra will become involved. He'll enter the stage, so to speak. We have been exploring the depths of a situation that is very selfish, and we have heard about Kashyapamuni's self-condemnation and lamentation, anger at himself for walking into a trap, a most delectable trap set by his delectable wife. And now Kashyapamuni is going to rally his forces, so to speak, and fulfill his position as the Grihapati, as the master of the home. He failed with his brahminical powers to see Diti's real motivation, to see through her artificial behavior. Why artificial behavior? You might ask, what's wrong with her waiting on her husband hand and foot and smiling and being very tender? Isn't that what it's all about? The behavior is called artificial because she had an exterior motivation. She was angry at Indra and wanted to rub him out, because she blamed Indra for the death of her two sons at the hands of Lord Vishnu. We ended yesterday with Kashyapamuni coming up with an ingenious package to save the day. He was going to utilize Diti's selfish motivations to get her to perform devotional service. And he assured her, if you follow this package that I've designed, this sadhana package, rules and regulations of devotional service, I can assure you that within 1 year, you'll have a son who can kill Indra. But if you happen to slip up and make a mistake executing this vrata, this vow, pumsavana vow it's called, you'll have a son who will not be the killer of Indra. In fact, you'll have a son who will be the friend of Indra. And you heard Diti's response. Please tell me what the whole sadhana practice is. I'm ready to follow it. She had no doubts. I will not slip up. I'm going to get what I want. So in this way, she demonstrated the first three ingredients of success in sadhana bhakti. Utsaha nischaya dharya. Enthusiasm, patience, and determination. She had no doubts. I'm executing this program. I'm going to get what I want. This is Kashyapamuni's brilliance. He's actually designed for her a purificatory program. Dangling in front of her nose, the fulfillment of her selfish materialistic plans. So you see, devotees of the Lord are expert. They know how to devise the ways and means that even persons with material desires can take up devotional service. Because as stated in the second canto of Bhagavatam, akama, sarvakama, mokshakama, udara, deep, whether you're akama, free from all material desires, sarvakam, full of material desires, or you're simply focused on getting relief from the material world, never mind tivraṁ bhakti yogena, engage in devotional service to Krishna. Yajeta buddhusha. Engage in devotional service to that supreme person. So it's not true that bhakti is simply for those who are pure in heart. And so unless you come to bhakti with really pure motivations, What's the use?
No. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Chaturvidha bhajante mam janah sukritino arjuna.
Four types of persons approach me with ulterior motivations. The distressed, the inquisitive, those seeking economic prosperity, and those seeking wisdom. Krishna says, Sukriti, they're all full of auspicious merit because they're approaching Krishna. So it is not that we are sitting around waiting only for the pure devotees to walk into the door. If that was the case, how many of us would be here? We recognize that people have material motivations. Candidates for devotional service have material motivations. And we deal with that through purification, by engagement in devotional service, and attentive hearing and chanting of Krishna's glories. We don't expect anyone to beat themselves up. Oh, I have material desires. Oh, what's the use of my being here? Woe is me. I hate myself. What's the point in all that? The point is to engage in devotional service rather than engage in the sense gratification of lamentation. So we don't expect that candidates to bhakti will torture themselves. Oh, I have material desires. Oh, let me cut off my head. On the other hand, we do expect that candidates in bhakti will be on a progressive path upwards. When one is an infant, one is an infant. You wear nappies and all that. But as you get older, we hope that you'll put on clothes. So, the point is that we should be progressive in our devotional service. Love is expansive. We don't want to just stay on the same level all the time. Love is dynamic. Bhakti is about real love. So you want to experience, you're coming closer and closer to Krishna. So that takes some work. It takes some career planning. One statement by Srila Prabhupada in Chaitanya Charitamrita, that this Krishna consciousness effort is meant to attract all types of persons, whether they're free of material desires or not. Let them all come, even they have ulterior motives, meaning they want material enjoyment or material relief. Never mind, let them come, and by the association with purifying devotees, such persons will become purified. Srimad Bhagavatam 6th Canon, Chapter 18, Text 75. Translation. This is Indra speaking. The ultimate goal of all ambitions is to become a servant of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. If an intelligent man serves the Most Dear Lord, who gives himself to his devotees, how can he desire material happiness, which is available even in hell? An intelligent man will never aspire to become a devotee to achieve material happiness. That is the test of a devotee. As Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu teaches, Nadanam Nadanam Nasundarim Kavitam Ba Jagadisha Kame Mama Janmani Janmani Ishvade Bhavatad Bhakti Oituki Toi. O Almighty Lord, I have no desire to accumulate wealth, nor do I desire beautiful women, nor do I want any number of followers. I only want your causeless devotional service, birth after birth. A pure devotee never begs the Lord for material happiness in the shape of riches, followers, a good wife, or even mukti. The Lord promises, however, yoga, shemam, vamyaham. I voluntarily bring everything necessary for my service. Om Jnana Chivananasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chokshu Vaditam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namah.
Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasudhi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda.
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare.
Hare Rama, Hare Rama,
Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
It'll be very interesting how Indra reaches this conclusion, because he's going to add a new dimension of selfishness to this whole episode. He's going to go on the, well, you could say defensive, but actually it's the offensive. He's going to act on the principle that the best defense is a good offense. So he's going to be very proactive. Meanwhile, though, in the purport, we have this statement: an intelligent man will never aspire to become a devotee to achieve material happiness. This is the test of a devotee. Now, we just spoke about how candidacy for bhakti is open to anyone and everyone, whether they're free of material desires or full of material desires. So why is it now that we hear an intelligent person will never aspire to become a devotee to achieve material happiness, and that this is the test of a devotee? Well, to be a real devotee is not an ordinary thing. To be a Vaishnava is a special thing. We consider ourselves that we are trying to be Vaishnavas. For the Vaishnava, that is a very, very special category. Sometimes in Bhagavatam, Srila Prabhupada uses the term devotee, or even pure devotee, very liberally and sometimes very strict. Why is that? It's like the difference between an unripe mango and a ripe mango. The only difference is time. If the unripe mango stays in the sun, on the windowsill, it'll become ripe. So in that sense, all devotees are pure devotees. It's just a matter of time separating them from the completion of their devotional maturity. On the other hand, we need to distinguish between those with inferior motivations and those with superior motivations. So the test for being a real devotee, in the strictest sense, is that we never aspire to serve Krishna for material happiness. Of course, in our happiness classes during the Christmas festival, we spoke about what is real happiness, what is false happiness. And hopefully we relieved ourselves of the jitters that what's the point in practicing bhakti if I'm not going to be materially happy. Your material happiness, as we discussed, will come and go based on your past karma. The intelligent devotee thinks that when material happiness comes my way, I am diminishing the results of my pious activities. And when material distress comes my way, I'm diminishing the results of my impious activities. When a bhakti yogi is in an apparently material difficult situation, he or she thinks, I actually deserve worse due to my atrocious activities performed in this life and previous lives. Why is Krishna so merciful? He hasn't given me all the suffering I deserve. And when a devotee is in a situation of so-called prosperity, so-called comfort, the bhakti yogi thinks, Krishna is giving me this for increasing his service, that's all. Let me utilize these circumstances of so-called prosperity and so-called comfort to increase my dedication, increase my service to Krishna. What's happening with Indra? Alright, let's go to where we left off yesterday. A point where Kashyapa Muni unfolds his plan. How
to save Indra by way of his wife's purification. He's lamented, he's condemned himself, and now he's being proactive. And he's, so to speak, fighting fire with fire. Alright, she's going to fight this. Well, I'll utilize her selfish purposes and have her act for her purification. So in this way, Kashyapa Muni, you could say, regains his status as a spiritual leader of the home after being overwhelmed. By his wife's machinations. He's going to give her a complete sadhana program for all aspects of behavior to a very minute degree. This is another yuga, so the austerities he's giving her are meant for that time, covering every minute aspect of daily activities. We spoke yesterday about Diti's enthusiastic response. She was determined. In that way, we spoke yesterday how there's something good amidst all this. Her natural feminine ability to follow instructions is going to do her the best of good, because the one who is giving instructions is giving instructions that are all good. He's going to, Kashyapa Muni, her husband's going to arrange for her attachment to devotional service. In that way, Kashyapa Muni gets out of a jam, so to speak. Indra gets out of a jam. And so does Diti. What's the jam that Diti's caught in? Material desires, revenge, anger, envy. All these lower impulses. The first thing Kashyapa Muni tells her, it's a long list, quite a few verses of aspects of behavior. My dear wife, to follow this vow, do not be violent or cause harm to anyone. Do not curse anyone and do not speak lies. Do not cut your nails and hair, and do not touch impure things like skulls and bones. She'll probably ask us to first take note of the fact that Kashyapa Muni's first instruction to his wife was, don't be envious. In other words, how can anyone make spiritual advancement when there's envy? The Sanskrit word for envy is matsarya. Literally, it means intolerant of anyone occupying what seems to be a superior position. You can't stand it. You can't stand it to such an extent you actually plan to drag them down or belittle them somehow. You just can't tolerate that there's someone apparently superior. Actually, a real devotee recognizes that everyone is superior. But the envious person picks out a few. You're in a superior position. And so that envy festers in you. And then gradually you start to act on that envy, subtly and grossly trying to cut the person down. This is the essence of material existence. We come here because we're envious of Krishna.
We've spoken before how envy is actually indirect appreciation. You're never envious of someone who's worse off than you. Someone who's sick or very poverty-stricken or has some kind of material problem. You never go up to that person and say, you know, I really envy you. How sick you are. How troubled your life is. I really envy you. No, you always envy someone who you think is superior, who has something that you don't have, you think you don't have. Why do you have it and not me? But envy is actually indirect appreciation. So why not make it direct appreciation? You are doing better. You are better. I appreciate that. You have these qualities. You have those qualities. Let me try harder and also develop these qualities. So you spin envy around by directly appreciating rather than indirectly appreciating, because you're never envious of someone who has something that you actually don't appreciate. So this is how to break envy down and reshape it in the proper way. Just appreciate someone who you're envious. Someone who you're envious of. Just go figure out what you're envious of. Oh, you do things so nicely. And just tell the person, you're doing wonderfully. Someone who maybe they do this service better than you or that service, just go up and say, how wonderful you do that service. I wish I could do the same. Then the envy melts away and everyone becomes enlightened. Bhakti is not for small-mindedness. And envy makes us very small-minded. A Krishna conscious person is known by not having envy. Bhagavatam, right in the beginning, in the second verse of the entire Srimad Bhagavatam, says, Paramo Namatsaranam Satam. Bhagavatam is meant for those who are pure in heart, swan like persons who are pure in heart, free from envy. Namatsaranam. So, this is something we have to work on. And it's easily dealt with by just directly appreciating. Instead of, why does this person have all that? Then just go up to the person and say, you're really doing wonderful. I wish I could also do as well. It's amazing what you do. Because in devotional life, in the devotional world, it's actually Krishna who gives the good qualities, Krishna who gives the abilities. It's Krishna's Shakti, Krishna's potency that makes things happen. So we don't want to make the mistake of being envious of Krishna. When we see his parts and parcels do something wonderful, we should know this is Krishna's working. So it's not that you said, well, anyway, it's all Krishna, it's not you, so I'm going to push you down. No, you're happy that the devotee is manifesting Krishna's Shakti. You may notice envious people are miserable. Their face gets crooked. Their face is, you know, like a cloud over it, and it's crooked. They're plotting. How can I minimize this person, drag this person down? Why him and not me? Why her and not me? It's miserable. Has anyone noted that they're happy when they're envious? You're envious of someone who has what you don't have. Why does she have such a nice husband and I don't? I have no husband. I'll take care of that really quick. Mm-hmm.
does he get all the attention from Guru Maharaj and I don't? It is not uncommon for devotees to think that someone who is apparently physically more in proximity with the Guru is more advanced. As young devotees, we all thought like that about Prabhupada's servants and Prabhupada's secretaries and all that. they must be the advanced devotees. And then when those devotees might have had some problems, we were all shocked. How? They were with Prabhupada all the time. How could that happen? So Prabhupada himself clarified the situation. He said, if you want to judge who is dear to me, and who is most advanced, just by who's physically closest to me, who's in the closest physical proximity to me, then I say the mosquito is the dearest devotee. Mosquito so close to me. But what's the purpose of the mosquito? To bite me. So he warned about material vision, judging who is advanced by who is closest physical proximity. Kashyapa Muni has instructed Diti not to be envious. You read the purport. Thus, Kashyapa Muni's instruction that his wife not be envious indicates that this is the first stage of advancement in Krishna consciousness. Kashyapa Muni desired to train his wife to be a Krishna conscious person, for this would suffice to protect both her and Indra. Speak of benefiting the whole world. So now you see the glory of Kashyapa Muni. He was down, but he rallied himself and transformed the whole situation. So he gives his wife a whole package of austerities and prohibitions to perform. Don't do this, don't do that, never do this, never do that. Actually, by giving negative instructions, don't sleep in this way, don't drink water in that way, don't dress yourself in that way, he's actually instructing her positively how to be a Vaishnava. He's going to just, how do you say, forbid anything that could in any way be impure. And at the end, he's going to tell her, one should worship the cows, the brahmanas, Lakshmi Devi, the goddess of fortune, and the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So he's just kind of giving her a total lifestyle of purification. Cleanliness internally and externally. Like, don't do this, don't do that, don't do that. And at the end, do devotional service. This is the mercy of a Vaishnava, instruction how to become purified. If you want to look to see if you have the mercy of a Vaishnava in your life, see if there's instruction how to make spiritual advancement. Cling to those instructions as your life and soul. Don't take them for granted. Dismissing them one way or another, various rationalizations. So Kashyapa Muni continued by explaining once again, if you follow this vow with faith for at least 1 year, you will give birth to a son destined to kill Indra. But if there's any discrepancy in the discharge of this vow, the son will be a friend to Indra. So we spoke about how Diti gleefully agreed, I accept this whole purificatory process. Yes, she said, I shall do everything according to your instructions. So with great jubilation, she became pregnant. It's all part of the plan. Kashyapa, when he will make me pregnant, it'll be a son who can kill Indra. This is the way it works. See how powerful ulterior motives are. How we can get so bent out of shape. Here, Diti wants to become pregnant to give birth to a son who will kill her foe, since she can't do it herself. To see how so consuming these ulterior motives are. Perhaps you would think she gleefully became pregnant thinking, oh, I want children. She already had children before, but another child to reciprocate with. She gleefully became pregnant. Now the killer of my enemy will be born. Time for Indra to enter the scene. Obviously, he's got a problem. If DT indeed discharges her vow properly, Indra is dead. Indra is not going to just sit around and do nothing, twiddle his thumbs. He's going to be proactive. Shukadeva Goswami explains, Indra understood Didi's purpose, and thus he contrived to fulfill his own interests. So you've got Didi's selfishness now versus Indra's selfishness. Following the logic that self-preservation is the first law of nature, he wanted to break Didi's promise. He wasn't just going to sit around and wait and see, does she follow the vow or not? He's going to be proactive and put himself in the position of being able to spot any slight weakness in her discharge of the vow and then take advantage. So what does he do? Once again, the power of selfishness. He goes to the ashram of Diti, who's his aunt, the sister of his mother. His mother is Aditi. So he goes to the ashram of his aunt and begins to render menial service to her. Wouldn't that seem like a very nice family thing to do? The nephew comes to wait on the aunt who's expecting a child hand and foot, to wait on her hand and foot and do menial service. Even though he's, you know, the king of the heavenly planet, still he's doing that. You know, how humble, how caring, how considerate. But no, Indra had his own selfish purpose. He's the king of the heavenly planets, yet he served his aunt daily by bringing flowers, fruits, roots, wood for yagyas, because his aunt's the wife of a brahmana, so yagyas are always going on. Kushagrass, that's needed for yagyas. Leaves, sprouts, earth, and water exactly at the proper time. But what does Shukadeva Goswami compare this behavior to? He says it's like a hunter who covers himself with a deer skin just to get close to a deer. Similarly, Indra was actually the enemy of the sons of Diti. Outwardly, he put on this false behavior. Very friendly and very faithful, serving her hand and foot. So just like, remember, Diti had her ulterior motives in serving Kashyapa, now Indra's got his ulterior motives in serving Diti. What goes around comes around. Life gets really complicated with all these ulterior motives, doesn't it? So the hunter wraps himself in a deer skin and serves the deer. Obviously to kill the deer. Similarly, Indra is acting in that way. What was his purpose? His purpose was to cheat Dee, because as soon as he could find some fault in the way she discharged the vows of the Pumsavana Vrata, then he could take action. So he didn't want that motive to be known, so he served her so carefully, humbly. Isn't it horrible living in a world where everyone has material desires of motivation? Doing this and that for a particular purpose? However, as time was passing by, and this vow is for 1 year, the months are ticking by, and Indra is starting to panic. Why? Who knows?
Well, because she wasn't making any faults.
She wasn't making any mistakes. She was executing the vow perfectly. And that means Indra's dead. So he's racking his brains. How will there be good fortune for me? What will become of me? He was in deep anxiety, to say the least. Why isn't my aunt making a deviation in this vow? She's doing everything perfectly. You remember how determined Didi was. Enthusiasm, patience, and determination. As the months went on, Didi became weak and thin because of strictly following the vow. And maybe she became a little spacey because of fasting or all the physical austerities that were part of the program. She was, Kashyapa Muni had told her, never eat without washing your hands and feet after eating. Never do that. But she spaced out one time. And she went to sleep neglecting to wash her mouth, hands, and feet after eating. Indra was on to it. A slight deviation. Slight, but still a deviation. That meant he could now take action. There was a chink in Diti's armor. And Indra, with his mystic power, animosity, he could become smaller than the smallest. He had the 8 mystic perfections, Ashtasiddhi. Because Diti made this slight deviation, Indra had the ability to enter her womb. And while she was asleep, he did that. And the pregnant child within, Indra cut the pregnant child into 7 pieces. Each of those 7 pieces of the embryo also became embryos. And so 7 living entities began crying out to Indra. Meanwhile, Indra very matter-of-factly went on. He continued doing his business, which was self-preservation. He already cut the embryo into 7, and then 7 children were there now. He cut those 7 children into 7. Now there were 49. So all the 49 children began to plead to Indra with folded hands. Dear Indra, we are the Maruts, your brothers. Why are you trying to kill us? Indra started to have some realizations. They're actually not my enemies. Remember Kashyapa Muni's statement that if there was a slight deviation in Diti's vows, she'd get a son who was a friend to Indra. And now Indra is seeing that although he
in order to save himself, cut the embryo into 7 pieces, and then those 7 to 7-fold totals 49. They all were his friends. This is life on the higher planets where there's so much mystic power going on. When Indra saw that actually they were his devoted followers, he said to them, "If you're all my brothers, you have nothing more to fear from me." You see, in Vedic culture, cousins are also like brothers, cousin brothers. Maybe some of you had cousins, children of your aunt, uncle, who you grew up with, and they were just like brothers or sisters. Out of all this intense selfishness, something else is happening. Why is that? Because Diti had done devotional service and Indra had assisted her in devotional service. So that devotional service, that bhakti, became the predominant reality, regardless of everyone's nefarious motivations. In fact, because they were doing bhakti, they had become purified. So all those children, they started out one fetus, became 49 by the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because Diti was engaged in devotional service and Indra was assisting her. Shivade Goswami explains, "Because of such strength in spiritual life, the 49 Maruts were born. How then is it wonderful that the Maruts, although born from the womb of Diti, became equal to the demigods by the mercy of the Supreme Lord?" What comes from Diti is supposed to be demons. Yet we see that she gave birth to 49 devotees. It's the power of devotional service. We spoke yesterday about how Krishna is independent. The general principle is Dharma Bruta Bhuteshu Kamasmi Bhartasha. Krishna says, "I am procreation according to Dharma." Nevertheless, Krishna is independent. He can send the greatest devotee into the most demoniac family, like Prahlad Maharaj, or into a devotional family who's followed Dharma. Krishna can decide, "I'll send you a child that'll cause you to become detached." Remember Maharaj Anga in the fourth canto? He had Vena, the most horrible kid, who as a child used to kill his playmates, slaughter them like lambs. And then when he became king, he was even worse. Maharaj Anga didn't stick around for his son to grow up. He was so disappointed that in the middle of the night, he left for the forest. He renounced. So that's also part of Krishna's plan. But sometimes, to saintly parents, Krishna sends us children that just make the parents just throw their hands up in the air, and we're going to the forest to renouncing home. If you look at Srila Prabhupada's family life, for example, he was not at all satisfied with the spiritual performance of his wife and children. But there you have an example. One devotee I know met one son of Srila Prabhupada and in Mayapur, and the devotee was glorifying the father. "Do you know what your father has done? Do you know what he's done for the whole world? Such a glorious, rare, pure devotee was your father." And the son simply said, "All I know is my father left my mother."
to not acknowledge anything beyond that mundane fact. Now bear in mind that Srila Prabhupada did not leave home in his 20s, 30s, or 40s. He left home in his 50s, which is the Vedic system. Panchasurvam Panambrajate. So it's not like what you see these days where fathers abandon their children. You have so many devotees who grew up without a father. But it's not like that. Similarly, Bhaktivinoda Thakur had 12 or 13 children. Not all of them were on the pure devotional platform to the satisfaction of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Advaita Charya, the incarnation of Godhead. Member of the Panchatattva. Some of his sons were very extraordinary bhaktas and some were deviants. So in that way, Krishna is showing that it's not all about biological descent. So it's about quality, not biology. Therefore, we're seeing Diti, she's the mother of the daityas, the demons. She has given birth not to one devotee, but 49 devotees. So what's going to be her reaction when she sees what's going on? Because of worshipping the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Diti was completely purified. When she got up from bed, she saw her 49 sons, along with Indra. These 49 sons were all as brilliant as fire and were in friendship with Indra. And therefore she was very pleased. Why was she pleased? Because she had become purified. Her whole consciousness had changed. In the same way when Dhruva, after executing Narada Muni's instructions, he saw the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He was a changed person. What a fool I was, worshipping for material desires. I was chasing after broken pieces of glass. Now I have the greatest jewel. What a fool I was. He had changed by the power of the bhakti transformation. Similarly, Diti had changed. So she wasn't angry. Oh, what is this? I wanted a son who could kill Indra. Now I've got 49 sons who are all complete friends with Indra. Now she was happy. She recognized the Krishna conscious outcome because she had become Krishna conscious. Now it's time for Diti and Indra to, what's the word for it? To level with one another. This is all part of Vaishnavism. If there's been some misunderstanding, if there's been some miscommunication, it's always good to level with the devotee, to be straightforward. So I always advise devotees, when there's been some potential miscommunication, misunderstanding, level, be on the level immediately. I didn't mean it like that. You see, what I really meant was, I think it's possible you could have taken it the wrong way, but I didn't mean that. I'm sorry to give that impression. So that shows Vaishnava sensitivity. Even materially, it's a good quality when speaking spiritually, but when you're dealing with devotees, it becomes very important. If we become callous and forgetful about how exalted the opportunity is to deal with devotees, our spiritual advancement will be curtailed. We'll remain neophytes. The definition of a neophyte devotee, Prakriti Bhakta, Kanishtadhikari, is one who worships the Supreme Lord in the temple, worships the deity, bows down the deity, but has no idea how to treat devotees. That's Prakriti Bhakta, materialistic devotee. Venerating the Supreme Lord and being rough with the devotees, callous with the devotees. So to avoid that syndrome, we should always be very much on top of our dealings with devotees. You have like a video camera in your head that records your dealings with devotees and play it back during the day. Oh, I think I did something I didn't mean to do. And that devotee could take it the wrong way. You contact that devotee and, well, I didn't mean it like that. It could have seemed that way. And this encourages the other devotee. Well, I should also be sensitive. And after, gradually, the sensitivity becomes like an epidemic. Everyone's going, oh, actually, I didn't mean that. And then you have a loving group of devotees. But if everyone is callous and just hard-hearted and, well, he might have thought that I meant that, but so what? Tough cookies. It's a very unattractive group of people. Looks like the material world. So all it takes is one or two devotees to start this sensitivity in Vaishnava relationships. Apologies, clarifications. Bite your tongue sometimes. You know, the material tendency. Doesn't it really feel good if you just lash out with your tongue? Don't you get a good, nice, good material feeling when you do that? Just tell someone exactly where you think they're at. And you try to, try to justify it. Well, Vaishnavas are straightforward. I told that devotee exactly what I felt about that devotee. That's straightforward. No, that's not being straightforward. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, the austerity of speech is to be truthful, and that truth is expressed palatably in a way that doesn't agitate someone's mind. Anudvegam kaivakyam satyam priyakatamchaya. You speak words that are dear and truthful and don't agitate the mind. Of course, if you are in a situation, if it is part of your service to correct, then sometimes you may have to say things which could potentially agitate someone's mind because that person doesn't want to take the medicine or recognize that they need correction. It's a real dilemma. When to say something, when not to say something. I have to go through this all the time. The Vedic statement is that those whom you love, you correct. So a real disciple is always begging for correction because a real disciple understands that's love. It's not love when you never say anything. Well, you can't say anything to that devotee because he or she will just flip out. Is that good? So the genuine disciple wants to act in such a way that he or she attracts correction because the correction is for the disciple's benefit. And the disciple recognizes that sometimes, because of my own material contamination, when I'm corrected, my mind rebels. No, no, it's not like that. You don't understand. But Vaishnavas don't hire defense attorneys. Generally, they think that you're pointing out a fault in me. I don't see it, but I'll just look harder. I'm sure it's there. So you see, there's a world of difference in Vaishnava dealings. Between Vaishnava dealings and mundane dealings, a world of difference. So we can start to honor each other's presence by being careful and sensitive. Monitor your own behavior. Do the video recording of your interactions, your Vaishnava interactions during the day, and play it back. When you're riding on the bus or driving in a car, you know, during a quiet time of the day, just play back the video recording, like a security camera. Play it back, and oh, that doesn't look like what I said. It doesn't seem that what I said earlier in the day came out right. It could be misinterpreted. I don't think I was being as sensitive as I could be.
And then you make adjustments. You go to the person to make adjustments. What do you think? Isn't that a very nice way to coexist? So now, Diti and Indra are going to level with each other. First, Diti starts the process, putting all her cards on the table, because both Indra and her have been they've been really maneuvering and counter-maneuvering and full of selfish desires. So Diti says to Indra, "My dear son," everything's lovey-dovey now, sincerely. I mean, after all, Indra's the son of Diti's sister. "I adhere to this difficult vow just to get a son to kill you 12 Adityas," the sons of her sister, Aditi, are called Adityas. So here, Diti's revealing. It's not simply I wanted to kill you, but also all your brothers. All of my sister's sons. In other words, let my sister suffer the death of her sons like I've suffered the death of my sons. That's justice. But Diti is now marveling. "I prayed for only one son, but I see now I have 49 sons." She's just delighted. "I got 49 sons. I only bargained for one. I got 49. How was that?" She's asking Indra, "How did this happen?" "My dear son Indra, if you know, please tell me the truth. Do not try to speak lies." 49 sons. Of course, these days, if a woman had 49 sons, she'd be But Diti had the ability, this is the heavenly planets, to maintain 49 sons quite easily. The principle is that no one should have children that they cannot maintain materially and spiritually. So she's asking Indra, "What's happened?" And Indra is going to put his cards on the table also. "My dear mother, because I was grossly blinded by selfish interests, I lost sight of religion. When I understood that you were observing a great vow in spiritual life, I wanted to find some fault in you." So at that moment that Indra saw the slight fault, he was able to enter her womb and cut the embryo to pieces. So he admits, "I was covered over completely by selfish, intensely selfish desires. I lost sight of Dharma." So now they, without reservations, have revealed their minds to one another. They both explained their intentions, their devious intentions. Cleared the air, so to speak. And that way, instead of both of them being enemies, they freely spoke the truth. So this is another way of Vaishnava relations. To try to clear out the fog, clear out the static, and cooperate in a proper way for Krishna's service. What brought about all this intense transformation? Both Indra and Diti had engaged in devotional service. Not with the best of motivations, but still they engaged in devotional service. Therefore, the mercy of the Supreme Lord was attracted. And even though Indra acknowledged this, "I cut each of the children to 7 pieces, and then another 7 pieces. 49 altogether. But by the grace of the Supreme Lord, none of them die." So what was Indra's conclusion?
My dear mother, when I saw that all 49 sons were alive, I was certainly struck with wonder. I decided that this was a secondary result of your having regularly executed devotional service in worship of Lord Vishnu. It's not the main result. The main result is to please Vishnu, to please the Lord. But Indra said, there's a secondary result that your sons were all saved. Indra clarifies that actually those who are genuine worshippers of the Supreme Personality Godhead don't want anything material from the Lord. They don't even want mukti, liberation. Nevertheless, in the Lord's own way, he fulfills the desires of the devotees. In his way. Not as you might have predicted, but in his own way. This is the mystical part of devotional service, and Indra's pointing it out. And indeed, he clarifies the verse we chanted. In the verse we chanted today, the ultimate goal of all ambitions is to become a servant of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. If an intelligent man serves the most dear Lord, who gives himself to his devotees, how can he desire material happiness, which is available even in hell? I remember the test of a devotee. A real devotee will never aspire to use his or her being a devotee for attaining material happiness. Meanwhile, the Lord himself brings everything a devotee needs for his service. So Indra concludes, "O my mother, O best of all women, I am a fool. Kindly excuse me for whatever offenses I've committed." This is Vaishnava. Indra points out, your 49 sons are unharmed all because of devotional service. Because of your great devotional service, your sons didn't die. The end result was that Didi was extremely satisfied by Indra's good behavior. The person she wanted to have a son to kill, she's now satisfied extremely by his good behavior. And Indra offers his respects to his aunt, pays profuse obeisances to her, and with her permission, he departs for the heavenly planets with his brothers, his 49 brothers, the Maruts. So just see, things end in a completely different way because of the power of bhakti. In spite of so many nefarious, selfish motivations, because there was devotional service, the mercy of the Supreme Lord was there. And both Diti and Indra became purified. And instead of Diti giving birth to demons, which was the norm for her children, she gave birth to devotees. She gave birth to demigods. Thank you very much.